threats in the wake of bin Laden's death have spiked.
Famine in Somalia.
Police pepper spray.
Vicious cartels.
Costa cruise lines.
Societal decay.
65 dead.
Tsunami warning.
Cyber attacks.
Drug war.
Mass destruction.
Tornado.
Recession.
Default.
Doomsday.
Egypt.
Syria.
Crisis.
Death.
Disaster.
Oh my God.
Hi, I'm Tim Cavanaugh for Reason TV. We're here with Peter Diamandis, who is the author of the new book, Abundance, The Future is Better Than You Think. Can you give us a brief description of what the book is?
Sure. A lot of people think that the world is getting worse, but they're wrong. The world is actually getting better at an extraordinary rate, at an accelerating rate. The human lifespan over the last 100 years has more than doubled. Childhood mortality rate has decreased by 90%. The per capita income per person adjusted for inflation has tripled. A Maasai warrior in the middle of Kenya on a smartphone today, on a cell phone, has better mobile communications than President Reagan did 25 years ago. And if they're on Google on a smartphone, they have access to more information and knowledge than President Clinton 15 years ago. But the reality is that as humans, we are constantly fed all of this negative information by media because that's what our brain preferentially looks for, because we evolved to watch for negative information as a survival technique. There's a real disconnect that humans have with reality. Today, an American under the poverty line, the poorest of the poor here in America, still have running water, flushing toilet, air conditioning, cell phones, majority have access to a car. They're living with a set of capabilities that the wealthiest people on the planet 150 years ago, the robber barons, the monarchs and emperors, would have been jealous of. We keep on moving this line of what poverty means. So this book actually talks about how the world is getting better and what are the forces driving us that way. The first force driving us towards abundance is rapid, exponentially growing technology. All of these things on Moore's Law, faster and faster computers that are enabling artificial intelligence and robotics and digital medicine and synthetic biology. These are forces and capabilities that are literally allowing individuals and small teams to do what only governments and large corporations could once do. Those technologies are being used by the second force, which is the DIY innovator, the guy and the gal who's driven by their passion and want to solve grand challenges, who are now able to do extraordinary things. The third force is what I call the techno-philanthropists. Today, there is more wealth in the hands of individuals than ever before, and these people are making their wealth at a younger age, in their 20s and 30s, and during an era of really social consciousness where instead of building buildings to their names, people are saying, I want to solve this disease or change education or healthcare. The final force, perhaps the biggest, is what I call the rising billion. The notion that on Earth we had 2 billion people connect on the internet in 2010, it's growing from 2 billion to 5 billion people by 2020. 3 billion new minds are being connected on the internet. These are people who've never been heard from before. They're going to become a massive economic force. There's going to be an economic dividend from these people as they begin to consume and buy and create and invent and generate value around the world. And people say, well, these are the poorest people on the planet. How can they possibly have, you know, a real economic impact? A few billion people who live on $3 to $5 a day, spending, you know, a dollar or two a day per year, that's trillions of dollars flowing into the economy.
One of the points of the book is that technology actually expands resources, and things that we think of as sort of speed limits are actually more malleable than we thought.
Technology is sort of a scarcity liberating process, and you know, the book is wrapped in a simulation of aluminum, right. And the first story talks about the fact that in the 1840s aluminum was more valuable than gold and platinum. See, even though the Earth physically is 8.3% aluminum by weight, all the aluminum is bound as bauxite, bound by oxygen and silicates, and so you don't find aluminum in pure form in the Earth. And it was very expensive to purify, and so it was the most precious pure metal on the planet. And then the process of electrolysis came along. and made aluminum so cheap. We have aluminum foil, aluminum cans, we don't think about it anymore. The same will happen in many fields. Take energy, for example. We talk about having energy scarcity. Even though the human race uses 16 terawatts of energy today, there's 16 terawatts of energy from the sun that hits the Earth every 88 minutes. We have 6,000 times more solar energy that hits planet Earth than we consume. The challenge is it's not in usable form. Last year, for example, in 2011, the cost of solar energy fell by 50%, to the point where in India today, it's half as cheap to get your electricity from solar than from diesel generators. And that trend will continue. The news feeds us up the negative stories, but not the breakthroughs going on in synthetic biology, being able to convert, you know, solar energy through algae to food and fuels far more efficiently. Take food, for example. You know, we had a green revolution, which has allowed us to feed the world far more efficiently, and all of the horrors around genetically engineered food never panned out. There's more GE crops than ever before, and it's because of them that we can feed people as well as we do. But that's just the beginning of the innovation that we have. You know, we're going from literally evolution by natural selection, which is Darwinism, to evolution by intelligent direction. There is technology right now in synthetic biology and biotech engineering that's going to allow us to convert that energy process 100 to 10,000 times more efficiently. And what that means is we're going to be able to create foods that are more flavorful, better for you, more nutritious, more efficient, more available than ever before. We're also going to start to change where the food is made. So one of the great ideas that we speak about in the book is vertical farming. You know, when you sit down at a meal today, the average food that you're eating has traveled some thousands of miles. Extraordinary expense. We are going to be moving to a world where we can actually create that food source locally, far more efficiently, far more nutritionally as well. And this is some fundamental change in the way we're going to feed people over the next few decades. People talk about the potential for water wars. The fact that we're living in a scarce water environment. In abundance, I talk about the fact that we're really living on a water planet. If you think about the fact that 70% of the planet is covered by water, the problem is that 98% of it is salt water. The remaining 2% that's fresh water, the majority of that is the polar caps. So 0.5% of the water on this planet is the fresh water. One of the DIY innovators, Dean Kamen, has developed a technology called Slingshot, which is a device the size of your dorm room refrigerator that is able to literally take any source of wet, salt water, the latrine, arsenic-infected water, the most polluted water on the planet, and turn that water into the purest possible drinking water for less than 2 cents a liter. Water so pure you can inject it into you. I want you to imagine this kind of technology in every village around the planet, offering them water at an extraordinary cheap price, much cheaper than we buy it here in the United States.
What about street parking or beachfront property or things that we would not, it doesn't really seem like there's anywhere you can expand that supply?
Take street parking as the example. We are within a decade away from having cars that are using artificial intelligence, they're robotic cars, the cars you and I drive, but they're fully automated. So I want you to imagine a world, you don't have to own a car anymore. You go on your iPhone, you pull it up and you say, I need a Ferrari today because I'm taking someone on a date. And a Ferrari drives up, picks you up, and you rent it if you would by the hour. Or I need an SUV because my family's coming into town. And you don't actually park a car. What you do is the car drops you off and then goes and does something else useful for the next 5 hours until you need it again. You know, your car is 95% fallow. It's sitting in a parking lot or in your driveway for 95% of the time. You use 5%. What a wasted resource. Imagine if the other 95% of the time it's off doing useful work for somebody else.
A lot of people are mad that banks and General Motors and so forth have been rewarded for their failure to adapt and have gotten bailed out. And do we owe anything to people who are getting displaced?
For us to prop up an industry which is an old school industry in a world that is exponentially growing is a real failure mode. You know, it's much better to say, listen, instead of building cars that could be built much better in other parts of the world, much cheaper, let's instead get into the you know, solar energy business or the battery business and so forth. Yes, it would be great to have a industrial base here in the United States, but does it have to be for 100-year-old technology, or can it be for something that we really can do much better here? I'd rather be investing capital in things that are transforming the economy, like what happens out of Silicon Valley. I mean, people forget how extraordinary the innovation coming out of Silicon Valley in the creation of Google and eBay and Facebook and all of the internet companies that are propping up our economy is. That's where we should be investing capital. That's where we should be creating jobs. Not, you know, manual labor that is soon going to be replaced by robots and artificial intelligence. You know, we see this flow of jobs from the United States to China or India because labor rates are cheaper there. What happens when labor is robots? And the cost of electricity in China and the U.S. are the same, and so the robot being in downtown Poughkeepsie or in Shanghai doesn't matter. Add to that, you know, 3D printing and 3D manufacturing, the ability to literally come up with something, think about it on a computer, print it out, see if it looks good, iterate rapidly and rapidly, we're going to see extraordinary innovation. Ultimately, I can't tell you what the breakthroughs are going to be because the rate of innovation is so fast. The challenge is, and what scares me tremendously, especially here in the United States, is that the government can't keep up with it. We're living in a world where when you say stem cell research is illegal here in the United States, all you're saying is, okay, top scientists, go and do your research in South Korea or China or India. It doesn't stop it from happening. It just goes someplace else. My concern is that the rate of change is so fast that the government's going to have a hard time dealing with this. So, as an example, we have partnered with Qualcomm. Paul Jacobs, the CEO, and I were on the stage at the opening of the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas, asking teams to build a handheld device that puts healthcare in the palm of their hands. It would be a device that is consumer friendly. Your wife, your mom, your kids could use. You can cough on it, talk to it, you know, do a transdermal blood analysis, and it will diagnose you better than a board certified doctor. What happens now? Does your phone become an FDA-regulated device? And can the FDA really figure out how to regulate that so fast? Or does that technology actually get launched in Africa or China or someplace else first before the regulations can catch up with it here in the United States? And all of a sudden, you've got better healthcare in the developing world than you do here. You go to the doctor now. You may have a series of tests. A CAT scan, a PET scan, a genomic scan, a blood analysis, and so forth. There's literally gigabytes of data. No doctor can analyze that. It really is going to take an artificial intelligence to look at all the information and be able to evaluate you. By 2020, we're going to be short 91,000 doctors in the United States. We have an overloaded emergency room. It's a broken system. The only hope that I see is going to be these AIs, these tricorder devices. I hope we're not going to be in a situation where entrenched interests are preventing the consumer from having better health care. So we're going to be transforming medicine in a big way.
There is always a critical mass of people who are willing to believe the whole argument that's, present company accepted, most people are too stupid to handle all of this information. That's why they need the experts to do it for them.
That's sad. It's sad, and all that will happen is we'll have better healthcare in other parts of the world, and that will just get people to stand up and notice and revolt, but it's too late at that point. We've lost our edge. I'm kind of tired of people going back and, it used to be such a simple, wonderful life in the 1800s and so forth. Yeah, when your life expectancy was 35, and you came down with a disease that we can cure now, and it killed you back then, and the child mortality rate was 25%, a quarter of your kids would die. I mean, if you want that kind of nostalgia, that's great. I guarantee you that they're very happy to have their cell phones and email and being able to go and Google something and order it on Amazon and have it arrive the next day. If they want to give that up, there is the potential to go live a life without technology. It's not forced on you. I best describe myself as a libertarian capitalist. If, in fact, the world is innovating and moving forward as an American and as an entrepreneur, I want America to take its values of democracy and capitalism and move them forward. The reason that we are speaking English in the United States is because the exploring ships out of China turned around in the 1300s and 1400s. Otherwise, they would have colonized the rest of the world, and we'd be speaking Mandarin. Thousands of years from now, people will look back at these next few decades as the moment in time that the human race moved off the planet. There's always going to be ups and downs to the economy, but on the whole, our ability to gain access to the basic needs, food, water, housing, health, education, is getting better and better and better.